Welcome to The Journey, a chronological study which goes through Scripture from Genesis to Revelation in chronological order.
All right. Well, so before we get started, I thought I'd catch us up just a little bit. We haven't done kind of a history check a little bit. It won't be very long, but just catch you up a little bit on what's happening in Rome with their leaders over the course of Jesus' life, leading up to where he is now in his ministry. So Augustus, remember that Augustus was the emperor, the Caesar, when Jesus was born, and he remains the emperor until 14 AD. In 13 AD, he begins one of those co-regency things with Tiberius. And so Tiberius and Augustus both serve kind of as emperors. When Augustus dies in 14 AD, then Tiberius becomes emperor by himself. And he remains emperor for the rest of Jesus's life. So throughout all this story, just for the reference, Tiberius is the emperor. And at the same time that Augustus dies, the Senate declares him one of the gods of Rome. So he becomes an official Roman god. The thing of interest that happens, or at least it's interesting to me, we'll see how much it relates to the rest of the Gospels, but it's an interesting sort of point, is that the other thing that happens is, so there's the prefect or the governor of Rome, in AD 14, Tiberius becomes the emperor, and Sejanus becomes the prefect or the governor of Rome. And what he does is he increases the power and the size of what's called the Praetorian Guard. So the Praetorian Guard was something that Augustus basically created when he became emperor. It was kind of like a personal secret service for the emperor. So they're bodyguards for the emperor. They protect the emperor. They sometimes literally would dress in just white togas and be very secretive and spy on people. And that was their job. And they were paid better than the rest of the guard, and they were given easier hours and workload than the rest of the soldiers. And the reason for that was the thought that if they were paid well and treated well, they would be loyal to the emperor, so he could count on them taking care of him. And that works for Augustus. When Tiberius becomes emperor, Sejanus, who is a member of the Praetorian Guard, becomes also the governor of Rome. And he convinces Tiberius to increase the size and the power and prestige of the Praetorian Guard. One of the things he does is he convinces Tiberius to build basically a barracks for the Praetorian Guard where they can live and stay. And so they all become centralized. And what Tiberius doesn't realize is that part of the reason Sejanus did that was so that they could conspire, so that anytime they didn't like an emperor, they could actually destroy him, assassinate him, and then put in their own puppets if they wanted to. So where they were intended to protect the emperor, they end up becoming really kind of a risky proposition for the emperor based upon whether they liked him or not. Tiberius is fine. They don't assassinate Tiberius, but when he retires, then Sejanus basically becomes emperor in all but official title. And Sejanus tries to marry into the family so he can become a legitimate heir and be officially the emperor. But in fact, he doesn't succeed in that. And he ends up losing out to Caligula. And then, not surprisingly, Caligula is ultimately assassinated by the Praetorian Guard. And so that's just a little bit of the story of what happens. And most of that happens over the course of Jesus's life. So Sejanus begins this whole project with the Praetorian Guard in AD 14, and then he basically dies in AD 31, so just a little bit before Jesus does. The other thing that is more relevant to us is what's called the prefect or the governor of Judea. So you'll remember, well, you might remember, or you might not, that the Herod was kind of over the whole area of Judea for a while. And then when he died, the Hebrew lands were divided into what are called tetrarchies or quarters. And it was divided into four quarters, and two of them went to Herod's son, another Herod, and he ruled over two of them. And then his brother Philip, who is sometimes called Herod, but is actually not a Herod, he's Philip, but he's his brother, he ruled over another third. And then the fourth quarter, the Senate decided not to give to anybody in that family. I think there was a little bit of, again, protection and division here so that Herod couldn't get too powerful. They actually give that to a member of the military. And And they give it to a military man who wasn't a Hebrew. And this military man, that his name was Valerius Gratus. And Gratus he's a prefect we don't know much about, but he was a prefect for a period of time. Let's see, he was a prefect from 15 AD to 26 AD. So he stops being a prefect during Jesus' life, and we'll see why that's important here in a second. But during Jesus' life, most of the time, up to 26 AD, so before Jesus' ministry, but for a good portion of his life, Valerius Gratus is the prefect. And what's important to us, we don't know much about him, but we know one unusual thing about him. And that's that during the course of his governorship of Judea, the high priest changes five times, which is an unusual amount of times for a high priest to change. And Gratus is exactly the reason why. He keeps firing high priests and replacing them with new high priests. And although we're not for sure why that is, at least one historian speculates, and probably with good reason, that the reason for that is because the high priesthood became a bought position, that they would bribe Valerius. And so if he was bribed by the right person, he would remove the previous high priest and put a new one in. And by changing them five times, he gets five times as much money. He can just keep kind of shopping out the position. And so he gives it, the first one is a guy named Ananus. Then there's Ishmael ben Phabas. Then there's Eleazar. Then there's Arianus. Then there's Simon. And finally, Joseph Caiaphas. And so Caiaphas comes in at the end of all this. And he's a name we're going to see at the end of Jesus's life. And this story, the reason I'm telling you this is because it points to what we know. And that's that the priesthood was very corrupt during Jesus's life. And the zealots knew that, and they talked about it. The Essenes knew about it and talked about it. There's a lot of recognition. And this is an example that Caiaphas ended up being the fifth high priest with just a couple decades, and probably just because he paid the highest amount. And so there's very little connection to what a high priest actually should be doing or who he should be. And even his commitment to the priesthood is really questionable, obviously. He's just there for the power. So that's this significant thing about the prefect Gratus that's important to us. The other thing about the prefect of Judea that's worth knowing is that Gratus dies in 26 AD, and the next governor of Judea is, does anybody know who the governor of Judea is during Jesus's crucifixion? You probably do, but you're not used to hearing him as a prefect or a governor. It's Pontius Pilate. So that's a good guess. I figure a lot of you were thinking that. So that's correct. Pontius Pilate becomes the prefect after Gratus. And of course, he plays an important role, as does the Herod, who's the governor of one of the other tetrarchies. So Pilate and Herod are essentially equals. That'll be important when we get to their... get to the story about how they interact and why Jesus gets bounced between them. They're basically equals. Herod rules over two-fourths, half, I guess you could say, of the tetrarchies, or the quarters of the Hebrew lands. And then Pontius Pilate rules over the Judea itself. All right, so that's just a little bit of history there that is kind of crossing over parts we're talking about. None of that is specifically happening like at this moment, but a lot of it crosses over Jesus's ministry. And so I just thought, we hadn't talked about that for a while, so I thought I'd bring you up to date on all that. Any questions on that before we jump into Matthew chapter 8? All right. So Jesus has, in Matthew and Luke, they've just recorded the sermon of Jesus, kind of giving us a taste of the kinds of things he would always say. Maybe also writing of specific sermons, Matthew writing about one on the mountains, Luke writing about one on the plains, but both of them, you know, talking about the various things that he just preached all the time. And so then Matthew and Luke both continue with, as he concludes this sermon, wherever it is that they're writing about, he goes to Capernaum. And it doesn't mean even here that it has to be the same sermon. The idea that Jesus would go to Capernaum frequently is something we definitely know. And the reason that Jesus went to Capernaum frequently, you may not recall this, but Capernaum is essentially his home. This is where he has set up his home. This is like his headquarters, or his central place, or I think, again, simplest to understand it as his home. He does a lot of traveling. He's obviously a preacher who's traveling all the time, but he does have a hometown. and not where he was born and not even where he's raised. It's become Capernaum. And so what we see is he goes out in the surrounding areas, he ministers, he preaches, he does things, and then he comes back to Capernaum. And that happens over and over throughout the Gospels. So this is one of those moments. He's had his big, you know, sermon tour or whatever, and preaching circuit, and now he comes back to Capernaum. And there's this story that Matthew and Luke tell, which probably, this seems to me that the similarities are too close. This must be the same story, even though there's a difference that we'll talk about why there's a difference between them as we go. So Matthew 8, verses 5 through 13 reads this way. It says, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, as I mentioned, returning to his home base, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. So let's just talk just a second about the general idea of a centurion. On the one hand, the idea of a centurion would not be one that the Jews would have looked upon with sort of grace or happiness or comfort, or they wouldn't think well of centurions, because centurions by definition are the opposing oppressive army's soldiers. A centurion is a commander of a lot of soldiers. Interestingly enough, you would think that a centurion would be a commander of 100 people, and that makes a lot of sense and should be, but for whatever reason, centurions commanded about 80 people instead of 100. I don't know why they weren't called Octavians, but they nonetheless commanded a large troop, a large number of people. So they're important and they're significant. They have a lot of authority, but they're for the opposing army. So you would think that anytime they would come up in the Gospels, you know, we might see them as kind of the villains of the story. What's fascinating is that centurions come up in the Gospels at least 7 times, possibly more depending on how you understand some of the various characters, whether they are centurions also, but at least 7 times. And every single time that a centurion comes up in the Gospel, they are presented as good men, as honorable men, which I don't think is an accident. I don't think all centurions were honorable or good, but I think that the authors of the Gospels and Jesus himself kept pointing to centurions who were good people to, I think, again, break down the kind of preconceived notions that the Jews would have had. And in this case, we're going to see him do something. Sue, are you also coming in on your iPad?
Yeah, I got it to work, maybe.
Okay, cool. I was just making
then
sure.
And I can go to the kitchen and fix dinner. Yeah, now I can get dinner.
And not some random Susan that I didn't know. So, okay. Yeah. Well, there you are twice now. Well, that's weird. All right, there you go. Perfect.
Yep.
All right. Let's see, where were they? Oh, so centurions, they're often presented nobly, and this one is no different. In fact, in this short story given to us twice, we actually learn a surprising amount of things about the centurion, given how short the story is, and they're all good. Every characteristic we're given of the centurion is, in fact, a good one. He seems like a good person. He seems to understand things well. And so let's keep reading and we'll see kind of where it comes to. Jesus, so he says, Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. And Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? Now, you might think that's a weird question, but what's fascinating, and this is, again, one of the examples of the goodness of this centurion, is that this is a really unusual attitude that a centurion would have towards his slave. Under Roman law, a master can kill a slave as soon as it becomes sick or injured or not useful in work. So for this centurion to ask anybody for help because his slave is sick, it shows that he's someone who has some, at least he sees some value. Now, again, we don't know for sure if it's in the value of the human life or the work that the slave did, but if it was just the work, you would assume he would simply have that slave killed and get another slave, because one slave can do the work of another slave. So I think this shows he has some human feeling towards towards humans, which is good. The other thing is, it is weird that he is coming to Jesus. Because he is a centurion, and here he is coming to this Jewish Messiah, this Hebrew Messiah. So he's an interesting character right off the bat. He seems like a guy who cares about his servant and is willing to come seek help from somebody who's not Roman, not a soldier, you know, not in the power structure that he would be used to. And so Jesus, I think that's why Jesus asks, shall I come and heal him? I think Jesus is thinking, is that, I want everyone to know that's your request. You're not just telling me that someone's hurting. You've come to me for a reason. You care about this person. And the centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. Here's another thing that's interesting. He has some sensitivity. He understands the position he's putting Jesus in. Remember, I think we've talked about this before. If not, we will again. Although it's not in the law, there's nothing in the Jewish law that forbids this. It is absolutely Jewish custom and tradition and expectation at the time that Jesus is alive that a Jew would never enter a Gentile's house. That would have made the Jew unclean, is what they would have thought. And so when Jesus says, shall I come and heal him, the centurion recognizes, he's very humble, but he's also being very sensitive. He's recognizing that it would be awkward, even though Jesus offered to, which does tell us something about him that we already knew, that he's willing to do it. But he knows that it puts Jesus in an awkward position. And so he says, that's not really necessary. And he says it very humbly. Here's this powerful, powerful man who says to this Jewish nobody, in a lot of ways, as far as he could be concerned, he says, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. He's expressing what the Jews would have felt, that Jews should not go under Gentiles' roofs. And so he's very sensitive. He's very humble. He's not worried about kind of how it makes him look. He just wants this servant healed, but he knows that Jesus can do it without showing up. And so he doesn't want to put Jesus in that awkward space. And that's what he goes on to say. He just says, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. So here he is. Here's the centurion with 80 men that are under him, but he himself is under the emperor, or possibly the governor. He's an important person with a great deal of authority, but he understands both directions. He understands that when he's asked to do something, he does it. And he understands that when he asks his men to do something, they do it. And yet he sees Jesus as having that kind of authority. So he says, you don't even have to come to my house. I know that you can command the disease, the illness, the spirits. Whatever the exact sort of structure the centurion is thinking of, we don't know, but he's thinking that in one way or another, this illness is under Jesus' authority, that Jesus can make it go away just by commanding it, that he doesn't even have to be there. So it's a really an incredible grasp of who Jesus is and the authority that he has. It's an amazing step of faith, and to be so confident about it that he's not even going to put Jesus in the position of coming to his house. And even if it even removes the possibility that Jesus has become such a big deal that it's kind of fashionable to have Jesus come to your house, and maybe the centurion wanted that. But if that's the case, he's also spoiling that. He's doing this all very quietly, and he's just asking Jesus to heal a servant, and clearly that's all he cares about. And he believes that Jesus can do it without showing up. So there's a lot of faith here. There's a lot of humility here. There's a lot of confidence in Jesus' authority. And that's why it says, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed. So Jesus recognizes that. He's like, wow, this guy really trusts me. This guy really believes what I can do. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him. Now, I just want you to think about who's following him. It's his apostles, these 12 men, Jewish men, possibly also other apostles, women and men, or disciples at least, who are following him. They've all been following him. They've given up a lot. They've declared their loyalty to Jesus. They've declared their faith in who he is. And now he turns to them after having this conversation with the enemy, essentially, and he says this, truly, I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith, which has got to sting a little bit. And I think he was aware that it stung a little bit for the apostles, because surely they're thinking, well, what are we, chopped liver? What is this about? But I think part of the point, and Jesus, he'll go on here in a second, but I think part of the point Jesus is making is, you're already prepped to believe in me. You've been waiting for the Messiah all this time. For you to believe in who I am is one thing, and you still wrestle with doubts. But here's this centurion. He's not even of our faith. He's not been raised from a child to believe these things. And yet he has this much confidence in who I am that he doesn't even need me to come. So it is a big deal. And that's what he says. I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. But Jesus is also making a larger point. He goes on to say this, I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. So he's right out and out saying, don't be scorning the Gentiles. If the Gentiles have faith like the centurion does, guess what? They're going to be at the big feast that you thought was reserved only for Israel. They're going to be able to come. They're going to be part of it from all over, which does mirror a lot of the prophecies that were spoken, but were kind of forgotten. where it talked about people coming from the east and the west to worship the Lord. So he's just acknowledging that again and pointing to the centurion as an example. But he's going to go ahead and rub a little bit of salt in the wound that they're already feeling by going on and saying this. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He doesn't mean all of the Jews will, but essentially what he's saying is your bloodline isn't as important as you think. There's going to be Gentiles who will be at the banquet, and there's going to be Jews who will not be at the banquet, who will be thrown out. And what is the context under which he says this? It's faith. Do you trust me? Do you believe me? That's the bottom line. Those who trust me, whether they're Gentile or Jew, will be there. Those who don't trust me, whether they're Gentile or Jew, will not be there. Simply being born a Jew doesn't give you access. And simply being born a Gentile doesn't remove that access. So it's, again, that same message that Jesus has been giving a lot about the kingdom. And that's that. Hold on. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay, I just got a message that it can't access my microphone and speaker, but I hear you and you hear me. It's giving me a choice to either cancel, in which case my computer will restart, and I don't want to do that, or to click continue, in which case I'll have to enter a password. So give me a second to do that. Even though it's working, it's going to make me do something because I can't see my screen. All right. It's weird. Can you guys still hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. At least it didn't make it worse. It just told me now you can hear me, even though you could before. Okay. That was weird. Anyway, it's the same message he's been giving a lot, that the gospel and the access to the gospel is really broad, that everybody is welcome. And so he's using this centurion as an example for the Israelites to show them it's faith that is the issue here. It's who do you put your confidence in? Is it in me and my authority? Then you're good to go. Any other reason, if you're putting it in your lineage, you're not as good to go. And then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment. So before the centurion even gets home, although there's a question about whether he has to get home, we'll see that in Luke, his servant is healed at that moment that Jesus said so. Let me go ahead and read Luke chapter 7, because it's the same story. And I'll point out the one fairly significant difference that comes up and explain why I think it's there. And then I'll take any comments and questions you guys have. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. There, a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, this man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So first thing, according to Luke, the centurion sends some Jewish elders first. Matthew doesn't mention this. That's fine. I think there's a reason Matthew doesn't mention it, but it's not a conflict. It's just an extra detail at this point. So he sends some Jewish elders to Jesus first, thinking it'll prepare the way, right? He's a Gentile, they're Jews, so he's going to send some Jewish friends of his. And this tells us more about him, that he has Jewish friends who respect him because they see that he does love Israel and that he's actually put money towards building their synagogue. So here's a Roman centurion whose life is such an interesting hodgepodge and so complex. That here's this Roman centurion who's actually helping rebuild what his country has kind of torn down. Not literally, they haven't torn down synagogues, but the Jewish system. And so he's rebuilding synagogues. He loves the Israelites. He's what you would call a God-fearing Gentile, somebody who believes at least in the Jews, if not in the Jewish God, and probably for him in the Jewish God. So that tells us a little bit more about why he's going to Jesus. But then it goes on. It says, so Jesus went with them. So at this point, the Jewish elders come and Jesus heads that direction. It says he was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to him to say, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word and my servant will be healed, for I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. So this is interesting. This is a detail that actually is different and in one sense looks contradictory. In Matthew's version, the centurion comes to Jesus. And talks to him. In Luke's version, the centurion never comes to Jesus. He sends Jewish elders first, then he sends friends. And he actually makes the statement, not only that I am not worthy to have you under my roof, but he says, I sent servants to you because I didn't think it was even my place, that it was even, I was worthy enough even to approach you. And so it becomes a reasonable question. Is this a contradiction between Luke and Matthew? Is this two different centurions? It's a hard sell to see this as two different centurions, because if it is, they have a playbook on what they're supposed to say, because they say exactly the same things. I think what's happening here is a matter of emphasis. And I don't think in Matthew's mind that he's contradicting anything, but I think he knows the centurion didn't come. I think in Matthew's mind, it is about authority. And so for Matthew, remember, the centurion says to Jesus, one way or another, either himself or through his friends, he says, I know what it means to be under authority. I say, go, and someone goes. And when they go, they're representing me. And so, Jesus, I know that you can send your angels or your power or whatever it is that's your authority over disease. You can send it without actually being there, and it's just as if you were there. And I think Matthew is emphasizing that point by speaking as if the, I think he's not emphasizing that point. But Matthew understands that point in the story. So when he speaks of the centurion coming to Jesus, the fact that the centurion is actually coming through an authority he sent, through a stewardship of his own authority, it's the same thing. For the centurion to send someone is the same as for Jesus to send someone to heal the servant. And in Matthew's mind, I don't think they're different. But the reason Matthew doesn't mention that he sent someone else is because he wants to emphasize the connection and the willingness between the Gentile and Jesus. In other words, he doesn't want the distance between the Gentile and Jesus to become the focal point of the story. He wants authority to be the focal point. So he talks as if the centurion's there, because in Matthew's mind, he is. Authority, it's the same. And he doesn't want to increase that question about, well, Jesus and the Gentile didn't really interact, because Matthew really wants to emphasize the inclusiveness of the gospel. Luke, on the other hand, is wanting to emphasize, what was I thinking? There was something about this I was gonna say. Oh, Luke, on the other hand, wants to emphasize the centurion's friendship with the Jews, that the centurion has a reason to come to Jesus. He wants to give us that detail about him already being friendly with Jews. Which again, Matthew didn't want to emphasize that, so he leaves that part of the story out. Luke wants to emphasize that, so he significantly mentions that to kind of drive that point home. So to me, I don't have a conflict with that, because I think for Matthew, it's not a lie. It is the same as the centurion being there, and it fits their emphases better. Matthew wanting to really emphasize the outcast nature of the centurion and yet the acceptance of it, and Luke wanting to emphasize the friendliness of the Gentile to explain why he was there. I'll finish it up, and then I saw Meredith, you looked like you had a thought or a question at one point. Jesus says, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith in even in Israel. And then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. So that's the story. Any comments, questions on any of that? Meredith, did your comment or question get answered, or did you still want to say something? You're good. Anybody else?
I mean, he actually does.
You're still muted, I think. At least I can't hear you.
It doesn't say I'm muted.
Yeah, there you go. Now I can hear you.
This wasn't the question I was going to ask. That got whatever. In some ways, it does seem like he understands authority like better than the disciples. They're great and they're doing awesome and amazing, and I'm sure it would be a dig, but I mean, like, even later, like Peter, and maybe not all of them, but even later, like, Peter's like, well, no, you can't die, like, in other things, and the centurion almost seems to kind of like feel like Jesus is doing his thing, and but I guess if you're a disciple, you might kind of want to get more involved, and then like following him too, there might be that more of that temptation.
Sure. I think some of it is the centurion is primed. You know, the way he understands this is authority. And that is how he lives his life. The emperor says do something, he does it. He doesn't question it. He just does it. And I think not that Jesus doesn't want his apostles to think, but in one sense, he's saying, this is how your faith should look. You should trust me that much. You should understand my authority that well. So yeah, I don't think he's just saying it to sting them. I think he is being a little provocative so that they'll really listen to what he's saying. But I do think it's also true. At that moment, he's saying, in Israel, there's not a faith like this, which reaches beyond your comfort zone and beyond your boundaries and beyond what you're used to, and then says, I trust you so much, you don't even have to come. You just say what you say the word and it'll all be done. So yeah, I think you're right. It does make sense. And it is a great faith. It is an example of authority they don't understand in the same way that he does.
Although true, but now I'm thinking about it more. And I think in some ways, I mean, they might trust Jesus enough that he could say, oh, my brother's really sick. My sister's really sick. Can you please heal her? And Jesus would do that. Like, because even with Mary and Martha, they were like, why weren't you here? You know, and stuff. So, I mean, they have to be more practical, like put it into practice and stuff too, and figure out how everything goes together with it.
Well, that's interesting though. Even the story about Lazarus, everybody's concerned about whether he's there or not. And here the centurion is like, you don't even have to be here. So even there, it shows a difference in their perspective on it.
Although she said, though, even now, but then he was there. So, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. Anybody, any other thoughts? Anybody else? All right. So Luke goes on to tell us another story of a healing right after this. It says, shortly afterward, Jesus went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went with him. And as he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. So this is a funeral. This isn't just like they're just carrying a dead person out. It says that the large crowd from the town was with her. So this is a funeral. They're carrying him out either in some translations say open coffin. The idea is it's probably not a coffin at all. It's probably like a funeral. What do you call that? A pyre? A bier? What's the word? Anyway, the pallet that you lay them on. So they're carrying
a pyre.
Thank you. Pyre. That's the word I'm looking for. So they're carrying out this son. Now, obviously all deaths are tragic, but I think it is relevant to note that this is particularly troubling and particularly tragic and particularly hopeless, because it's pointed out to us that the dead person is the only son of a widow, meaning she's not only lost her last relative, she's also lost her last chance at survival. Remember that at this time, if you were a woman and you didn't have a husband and you didn't have a son to take care of you, there wasn't a lot you could do. You became a pauper. You became in trouble. And so I think that when Jesus is, we're going to see him respond in compassion. And I think there is something to the fact that as he sees this funeral service, he's not just aware that this is a tragic death. He's also aware that this is a tragic death, which has left the widow desolate. That she not only has to grieve over the loss, she has to fear for what's going to happen to her tomorrow. Because again, she has no other sons and no husband. And so that's what it says. It says a large crowd from town was with her. And when the Lord, and by the way, the word there for Lord is Kyrios. It really means divinity. So there's an emphasis here by Luke on God being, on Jesus being God at this moment. It says, when the Kyrios saw her, his heart went out to her and he said, don't cry. So he sees her, he feels compassion. He's like, it's okay. He's comforting her. These aren't empty words. He's actually about to give her a reason not to cry, but he's comforting her. He's like, you know, it'll be okay. And then he went up and touched the bier, I guess. They were carrying him on and the bearers stood still. He said, young man, I say to you, get up. And the dead man sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. This is one of those very Lucan statements, which there's just so much more story I want. As detailed as Luke is, every once in a while he throws these things in, and it tickles the imagination. I'm like, talking about what? You know, what is the first thing you say when you're brought back from the dead? It's just, the whole thing is an interesting picture that just begs for more understanding. So he says, get up. The boy gets up, he starts talking to her, and Jesus gives him back to his mother and says, here's your boy. He's going to be fine. You don't have to worry about tomorrow. It says they were all filled with awe and praised God. Not a surprising reaction. I think when you've seen an actual resurrection, I think that would be all our responses. They were all filled with awe and praised God. A great prophet has appeared among us, they said. God has come to help his people. And the news about Jesus spread throughout Judea and the surrounding country. I think it's also interesting that Jesus so often does his miracles very quietly and isn't trying to attract attention. And I don't think here he's trying to attract attention, but I think here he's just moved by compassion. I think this is the way it's expressed by Luke, at least. This is a miracle of spontaneity, which, again, that's a hard thing to, I can't get into the theology of Jesus being spontaneous. There's probably questions about whether that's even possible, but it feels like an act of spontaneity, a miracle of the moment where he just sees somebody and he's just compassionate. And he just takes care of it because he feels bad for the person. And because of that, he's not even considering the fact that this is going to, again, be a huge deal. Everybody's seen it. It's been in the public. It's been in open. He's already begun to kind of get a name that in some ways is bigger than he wanted. And this is just going to make it even bigger. But again, I think it's interesting. He wasn't worried about himself in that sense. He just was thinking in a lot of ways about her and his compassion for her. There's a funny story, too. D.L. Moody tells a story that he was asked to conduct a funeral service. And the very first time he was asked to conduct a funeral service, he decided to go to the Gospels and to find a funeral sermon delivered by Jesus. He thought, I have this recollection that Jesus saw a lot of dead people. So there must be a sermon. There must be something he said that I could preach at this sermon. But Moody said that it was a fruitless search because he realized that every funeral Jesus attended, he broke it up by bringing people back to life. So he said it didn't help him very much in coming up with a way to preach at a funeral. So I think that was kind of a funny story. All right. Any comments on any of that before we get to the story of John the Baptist? Yes, the return of John the Baptist.
I think it's funny that we want to know the details. Yeah. what did anybody say? And the truth is, the only thing that's important is what he did.
You know what? That's true. And the reality is, if we were there, we probably wouldn't remember the details because we were there.
And maybe Luke did, but he's so detail oriented. But it wasn't important to what he was trying to tell.
He is. Well, even that that's right. That's what it is that Luke is just detailed enough to kind of tantalize you because he didn't have to mention the guy started talking. He could have just said he brought him back to life and gave him back to his mom. But he just throws that in there and it's just like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, but you're right. If we were actually there, none of us would probably remember what the boy said anyway, or the man. I have no idea how old this son is either. It's not clear. So.
I was just noticing also, I think this is a huge thing, but that he touched the buyer instead of like the boy himself, and the idea of like not touching a dead person, and if that has and also too the authority to just say like get up, and like he would get up.
Yep. No, those are good points. I think one of the things that's interesting about Jesus' miracles is how often they are different, that he doesn't always do the same thing. There's not a certain incantation or a certain touch or a certain gesture, which I think helps us avoid falling into the trap of thinking there is sort of a magic spell or a magic way of doing things, but that it's Jesus doing it because he often does it differently and with different results. And this is an example where he doesn't touch the person. And which is really good. He does often speak to them, which I just find interesting because dead people theoretically can't hear. So again, it's just interesting that in his speech, he can reach, even just in speaking to them, he's reaching beyond the grave so that they're able to somehow respond to that.
Well, it's kind of cool too, because I think of, like Elijah and, how he laid on the boy like three times and how they already kind of thought maybe he was kind of Elijah, like Jesus was. And like how it's probably good to kind of like go beyond and make like a distinction, like I'm God, I'm,
Sure. Yeah, there probably are echoes even for those who watched it that Elijah, moment would probably come to their mind. And you're right, the fact that he doesn't have to lay on him three times might also occur to them. It was kind of easier for him almost. It absolutely was, but yeah, no, that's all good. Yeah, I like that. Any other thoughts? Anybody else?
Well, when you talk about not touching him,
that honors the Jewish tradition. So because you know they can't touch dead people, so he's staying within the norms of the religion, so he's not going to offend the Jews any more than he already does.
That's interesting. Right. Yeah, he's not trying to unnecessarily offend them. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I like that.
Great. I don't think it was easier for Jesus than Elijah, because I don't think Elijah was actually doing anything.
Yeah, I kind of thought that when I said it. You're right. I realized when I said it, it wasn't quite the right way to say that. You're right.
I love, though, that, yeah, he was just moved by compassion. And even just thinking about, like, when with Lazarus, like, when he would just, like, when he, like, wept, you yeah. know, because of, like, Mary and Martha.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and that he just can't help but, yeah, that he really, like, that's, like, who he is. Kind of like, you know, like he is love. He can't be anything else.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think one of the surprising things about Jesus to the Romans, and maybe to the Jews on a different level, you know, the Romans had a whole that. So we've talked about the schism among the Jews, that you have all these different sects. Well, Greek philosophy had the same issue. So at this point, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all these guys have been passed. And you have a bunch of different types of philosophers, Epicureans and Socratics and Platonics. And one of the groups you have is a group called Stoics. And we actually see them in the Gospels. We'll see them come up a little bit where they argue with Jesus about something. But Stoics, which might not surprise you because we borrowed the word Stoic from them, Stoics believed that to be like God was to be unemotional. They believed that God was unemotional. It was kind of an Eastern view of perfection, is that there's no passion. And so they believed that to be like God was to be unemotional. And one of the things that must have, well, I know it, again, we're going to see it in a second, not in a second, but later, that surprised them, and I think other Romans who shared those thoughts, even if they weren't Stoic specifically, is that Jesus is constantly emotional. I mean, he is regularly emotional and claiming to be God. And even, you know, I remember reading years ago that the phrase "had compassion on," which it speaks of, Jesus does a lot of miracles where it says he had compassion on them, that's an idiom. And the literal word, the idiom that means "had compassion on" is "felt the pain in the marrow of his bones." And that's what they don't translate it that way, because that phrase just would be weird to us. But that's what it means. It's a very deep compassion where he's empathetically feeling the pain that they're feeling, like deep in his bones. And that's who Jesus tells us God is on some level. And I think that's fascinating. I think that, again, I think sometimes we even have a tendency to think to be like God is to not be affected by anything. And yet Jesus was affected by this woman so deeply that he did this miracle. And he was affected by Lazarus and the sorrow of Mary and Martha so deeply that he weeps. You know, I think there are these examples that show us that his compassion is not superficial, it's to the marrow of his bones. So I think that's a cool thing that we learn about Jesus in these miracles too. All right.
Well, it made me like, it just kind of made me think too, because we've been talking some about this, and it's kind of struck me as we've gone through this, the idea that he kind of had to learn how to be like human and like experience that and just, you know, with like all that, and that he would like choose to do that.
Yeah, for sure. Which I don't think is to say, and I don't think you're saying this, but just for clarity, I don't think that's to say he didn't have emotions before he became human, but there is an aspect of being human and living in the midst of the suffering that is different, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, God, yeah, we see where God has emotions.
Absolutely. Like God is compassionate before the incarnation, for sure. We see that all over the place.
I wonder though, like, because Jesus is able to feel it too, I wonder if he can be like more like empathetic.
I don't know. That's a good question. Empathy specifically. I mean, Hebrews talks a little bit about that we have a God who knows, we have a Messiah, we have a Savior who knows.
High priest, like, yeah.
Yeah, who knows what it's like to suffer. So there might be something to that. Yeah. I definitely don't want to diminish. I think God has always been very emotional and is reflected that way in the Old Testament as well as the New. So I don't think that's like something he didn't have until Jesus, but you're right. There is a certain level of empathy, which even the Hebrew.
Well, I mean, God wouldn't feel it to the marrow of his bones because he doesn't have bones.
True. True. I think that's an idiom, though.
I'm sure it would affect him, like in some way.
No, it's a good question, and there is argument, by the way. There is question among even Christians about there's a certain understanding of God which says that essentially he isn't emotional, because to be emotional is to be changeable, and God can't be changeable. And I understand their argument, but I don't agree with it. I think God wants us to perceive him as being emotional, whatever that means. And so there's something there that we can call emotion. So I don't want to get too much into it, but just to point out.
Oh, you mean like in these specific instances, like when Jesus was moved with compassion and so he healed that? Like
just in general, they say that the definition of being emotional means being changeable, and the definition of God
can't be changeable. Make any sense to me?
Well, that's okay. It makes sense to me, but I don't agree with it. So it doesn't have to make sense to you. It's okay. Anyway, let's go on. Matthew 11 is the return of John the Baptist. And I just, being a story guy, I just love when characters pop back in that we thought were gone. So the last we heard from John the Baptist, he'd been put in prison. We're actually going to get more details on that later in retrospect. So we haven't been told exactly why he's been put in prison. But what we're going to hear later is that, so Herod Antipas of Galilee, so this is the Herod who's overseeing two quarters of the Tetrarch here. He pays a visit to his brother in Rome. This might be Philip, in fact. I think it is Philip the Tetrarch. So he pays a visit to his brother in Rome. During that visit, he seduces his brother's wife, comes home again, dismisses his own wife, and marries the sister-in-law because he manages to lure her away from her husband. And John watches all this happen, and he very publicly rebukes Herod. He says, that's just a lousy way to act. That's not good family relations, you knucklehead. And of course, you can't do that with someone who's a dictator and who has the power that he has and who doesn't like to be corrected, which all describes Herod. And so in Herod's revenge, he gets John the Baptist and he throws him into a dungeon. Now, he doesn't execute him because I think he knows that to do so would cause a pretty big kerfluffle, possibly a riot, possibly a revolution among the Jews. And he doesn't want to do that because Herod is very politic about keeping the Jews calm. And so he's mad enough, he has to do something, but he doesn't want to execute John the Baptist. So he throws him literally in a mountain dungeon. There's a fortress in the mountains near the Dead Sea there, where there's a dungeon in them. And he literally puts John the Baptist in the dungeon in the mountains. And so that's what happened. That's where he is. And that's where we pick up the story. It says, after Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on there from there to teach and preach in the towns of Galilee. Let's see. I have to go back over all my notes. When John, who was in prison, heard about the deeds of the Messiah, he sent his disciples to ask him, are you the one to come, or should we expect someone else? This is a really interesting question from John, and it's unclear why he's asking it. So there's two possibilities, and I think either one is equally plausible. One is, you might say, why on earth is he asking this? This is John. This is John who knew from God that Jesus was the Messiah. He's the one who told everybody else. He's the one who had the clarity. He knew directly from God's revelation from birth, almost, basically from before birth, that Jesus was the Messiah. How on earth could he be hearing? And it even says he heard about the deeds of Jesus. How could he be hearing about the deeds of Jesus and suddenly at this moment be facing doubt and sending disciples to ask Jesus if he is the Messiah or if there's someone else that should be coming? And I think there's two ways to see this. One is that John is human and he's in prison. And Jesus hasn't done what John thought he was going to do, perhaps. Perhaps like everybody else, John thought that what Jesus was going to do was overthrow Herod, was overthrow the Caesars, was overthrow the emperors. And so that hasn't happened. Jesus, he hears about Jesus' deeds, and none of them sound like Jesus being, you know, taking his throne and his place and overthrowing the government. And so maybe he's thinking, well, Jesus is obviously somebody important. He's doing really important things. But maybe there's someone else we should be waiting for who will be the Messiah that will overthrow the government. So it could be a moment of actual doubt, of actual confusion. And it's really important to John, because he's in prison for this, to know, did I waste my life? Is there something else coming? You know, just tell me. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that John is not facing doubt at all, but his disciples are. And as his disciples are with him and talking to him, he wants them to know that Jesus is the real deal. But being John, he does what John always does. Instead of John convincing them because of who he is, that Jesus is who he says he is, he sends them directly to Jesus himself. He's like, you guys go ask Jesus who he is and he'll show you. Go ask him and he'll show you. I think either one is possible. The second scenario actually fits the flow of Luke just a little bit better. Not a lot better, but a little bit better. And so I think either is possible. John is facing real doubt, or the disciples are, and he's sending them to Jesus to find out for themselves. I think either could be, but here's how the story unfolds. Are you the one who is coming, or should we expect someone else? And Jesus replied, go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. So this answer makes sense again in either scenario. If John is doubting, then what Jesus is doing is he's pointing out all the messianic things he is fulfilling and avoiding anything about judgment. There are prophecies that talk about Jesus bringing judgment. He's not talking about any of that, because that would be where John's confusion is. But he's showing him all these other things. Like, dead people are coming back to life. The good news is being proclaimed to the poor, which speaks of justice, even though not so much of judgment. And so he could just be saying to John, it's okay. And then when he says, blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me, I think what he's saying is, you can count on me. It's okay. You haven't wasted your time. You're not going to come to the end. It's going to be in vain. You're not going to come to the end and go, oh, I blew it. I went the wrong direction. He said, count on me and keep counting on me. You have not, you know, hitched your wagon to the wrong horse. You have not backed the wrong horse. You know, you are correct, and you're going to be blessed, because you went the right direction. So that makes sense. If it's just for the disciples' sake, it's essentially the same thing, except it's stronger in the sense that he's saying, you go back and tell John what you have seen. They've now seen and witnessed these things that John wanted them to see and witness. And then Jesus is encouraging them, be like John, don't stumble, keep being faithful. So either way, his answer makes sense, whichever way it's going. The bottom line is, Jesus is affirming his messianic position, that he is the Messiah, he is the one they've been waiting for, and here's all these proofs and all this evidence of his authority, that it is him, and that anyone who trusts that is not being led astray, that they're in the right place. And then Jesus begins to commend John to the crowd around them, which again, I think he would do whether John doubted or not. It doesn't take away from who John has been. And he says this, as John's disciples were leaving, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. Makes sense. These disciples came, they asked questions, he talked to them. He's like, so you guys know those guys were from John. Let me tell you about John. Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed swayed by the wind? He's actually, and it's kind of nice if John was doubting that Jesus is doing this, but even if he's not, it's cool that he's doing this. He's affirming John's faithfulness and strength. He's like, who did you go out to see? Was somebody that was easily blown here and there? Do you think I just persuaded him? No, you did not go out to see a reed in the wind. If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No, clearly John was not that. You didn't go out there because he was persuasive himself and had rich clothing. He says, no, those who wear fine clothes are in king's palaces. Then what did you go out to see? All, you know, so many people went out to see John. And so even in this crowd, there's people who aren't John's disciples, but they went out to see John. Jesus is like, why? Why did you go out? What drew you to him? And he says, a prophet? Yes, I tell you, I'm more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. So Jesus quotes Malachi. And in the book of Malachi, this is where the prophecy is that says that there will be a messenger who will come ahead of the Messiah, who will prepare the way for the Messiah. And then in Malachi, he identifies that person as Elijah. And what Jesus is doing here is saying he's not Elijah, but that's the point. That's the idea. That was a metaphor. That was the prophet Malachi was saying that somebody like Elijah, somebody who will come and be like Elijah in their prophetic ministry and in their calling ahead of what's to come and in their preaching of the Messiah to come, that's who John is. He is that person. So where John was asked the question, are you Elijah? And he said, no, because he's not. Jesus is pointing out he is nonetheless that person you were thinking about when you thought you were waiting for Elijah. He is the person who came to prophesy the Messiah. And by making this statement, Jesus is getting a two-for-one deal, because he's saying on the one hand, John is who you thought he was. But of course, by saying that, he's also saying, I am who you thought I was. So John was persuasive and he wasn't wrong. And here I am. And you knew it and you were right to know it. So don't waver. Don't fall into doubt. I'm not doing what you thought I would do, but you know that I'm the person that John called me out to be. He goes on, he says this, truly, I tell you, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. That is a huge statement to say. Not entirely clear because Jesus also was born of woman, but we'll just leave that as it may. I'm sure he's not saying John the Baptist is greater than he is. I think we can call it hyperbole. He says, yet whoever is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has been subjected to violence and violent people have been raiding it. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you are willing to accept it, he is the Elijah who is to come. Whoever has ears, let him hear. And if you're waiting for my brilliant insight on this whole comment about the kingdom of heaven being subjected to violence, I don't understand it. I don't know what it means. I've read a lot of commentaries on it. None of them really satisfy me. Some of them say it's saying that it's been violent up until now and that people were expecting violent revolution and Jesus isn't going to bring that. That's possible. Some are saying, and traditionally a lot of preachers have said that what Jesus is saying is there's a certain amount of initiative and aggression that's required to enter the kingdom of heaven. That feels weird. So I don't know exactly what this is saying. Do any of you have any thoughts before we go on?
Well, I mean, that second option feels especially weird in light of the Sermon on the Mount being pretty recent, where he talked about how meek and poor and humble you needed to be to enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, I agree.
But if he is saying, you know, this was kind of the previous, it could be furthering what he talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, sort of this is, I'm subverting the way you've been looking at things. It has been subject to violence because you've been expecting that kind of revolution. And that's not how he's.
I like that. That's a good way to put it. I like that thought. That's a good thought. I'll chew on that. Anybody else?
Maybe. Okay. I kind of have a half form thought. I don't like just bringing about the kingdom of heaven has been, especially with like the law and the prophets and up until like Jesus, it has been subjected to violence. I mean, they were like, and it's come about like everyone was trying to like, well, like not everyone, but it was getting like trying to be like suppressed and everything like that. And like with, I guess with Satan, demons and other people or whatever. And like the prophets that were like, you know, like killed and stuff like that. And I don't know, it just kind of seemed like possibly then the idea of like, you know, Jesus being the, I guess it says from the days of John the Baptist until now.
That's part of what confuses me about both your and Lorian's answer, which I think are good answers. But yeah, he doesn't say up until John the Baptist. He says from John the Baptist till now, which is weird.
But yeah, because then in 13, it says for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, but it doesn't like include them in the things.
Right. He's talking about two segments. From John the Baptist till now, it's been violent. And from before John, it was the law and the prophets. I don't get it. I don't know what the point is. I'm a little mystified by it, honestly.
Well, and I mean, Jesus is going to die. Is there any chance he's looking ahead to the when he's subject to violence?
I think that's always a possibility. I think Jesus often says things about his death that we don't understand. So that certainly there might be something there about that. Maybe so.
Well, and just the idea of like combining them too, I guess maybe kind of like what Lorian was said, because it does say, and violent people have been reading it for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, which kind of seems like with that, maybe kind of like it's been subjected to violence and violent people have been like reading it. And maybe kind of the idea of too, because he's talking about like John the Baptist right now.
And John is also suffering violence, right? And he's also going to be, he's in prison. So there might be something there about that. The other thing about this.
Well, and also to the idea of, sorry.
No, go ahead.
You can go ahead and finish.
No, go for
it. Well, I was just kind of thinking too about like, maybe like you were talking about like with judgment with John the Baptist, and maybe he was expecting at least like some or like whatever, especially since it kind of was prophesied. But then the idea too, like that it's, yeah, like it's not as much like with that. I kind of lost my thought, train of thought in the middle of that. And I think that was kind of somewhat what you guys said. I don't know.
I think it is difficult. And I'll just add this one last piece of difficulty. I don't understand what any of it has to do with Elijah, because he begins and then ends with that thought. If you're willing to accept it, he is the Elijah who was to come. So I understand his point about John being Elijah. I don't understand how this middle part supports that. It's almost like Jesus is saying something that is supposed to support the idea that John is the Elijah before him. And I don't, that's what I don't see that connection. I believe it's there, but I don't get it. I don't know what I don't know why that's a supporting.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Those seem somewhat connected, but
violence and John being Elijah.
Well, the like John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven being subjected to violence, and the violent people, like with the prophets before, when like it was like Elijah, and kind of those seem somewhat connected.
Yeah, you may be seeing something I don't see. I hear the words you're saying. I'm not, that connection's not making itself in my brain, but you may very well be seeing it, and I'm not.
I don't know. But
I mean, Jesus saw it, so I believe you might be seeing it, and you're saying the same words he did.
Well, especially since it says like, and like, it's talking about two different like time periods, but it says like, and so it seems like possibly that it's like a similar like thing, and then connecting John the Baptist and Elijah like he's been doing like for them.
No, I understand the conclusion that John the Baptist and Elijah are connected, but I see and you're right, that and if you're willing to accept it, that's what I don't understand. You're right.
No, I was saying not that, and that, and violent people have been raiding it.
Oh, that's the same time period as from the days of John the Baptist until now, though.
Yeah, I think so.
All the prophets and law prophesied, but it goes right into, I mean, maybe, but it seems like at least somewhat connected, because then it goes into, for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. So that's obviously before John.
Correct. So there's two time periods being spoken about. I guess for me,
I have a note in the Bible that says, instead of subjected to violence, it says, or has been forcefully advancing.
What right. About that? And that's the traditional view, which is that the kingdom of heaven is brought about by aggression and initiative. And that's where I'm like, that didn't quite make sense to me.
That's not necessarily what forcefully advancing means. If it's from John the Baptist till now, it's been forcefully advancing. He could just be saying all the law and the prophets for hundreds of years were leading up to this. And then from John, it really picked up the pace because now Jesus is here. So it's been forcefully advancing. There's still this violent people raiding it, so I don't really know what to do with that. But I think that the idea of forceful advancement could be aggressive in speed of advancement, but not necessarily in like manner of advancement.
That could be.
Yeah, and that's what I was kind of thinking too before, and like with the opposition of before it, and then it's saying, yet whoever's the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. So it seems some ways it's talking about like the kingdom of heaven too, not necessarily. And like Jesus is the fulfillment of the kingdom of heaven. Like
definitely talking about the kingdom of heaven, because he says that again when he says, from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has either been forcefully advancing or subject to violence. So he's definitely talking about the kingdom of heaven. Yeah, no, it's good. It just, for me, I hear everything you guys said, and you again, I'm not being facetious. You may feel or see a connection I don't see. I just, the whole section about the violence, I'm missing. I don't understand the rest of it. I get if he went from whoever is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he, for all the prophets and law prophesied until John. And if you were willing to accept it, he is Elijah who was to come. If it read like that, it all makes perfect sense. Flows, I get the connection. It's that middle section about violence that I don't understand how it's an argument for John. However, when you guys both said it might be about forcefully advancing, kind of saying it picked up speed from John the Baptist, that's the closest I've gotten to seeing a connection, in that he's saying he's the Elijah in that sense. He's kind of heralding that it's picked up speed. And maybe that is what he's saying. you do have still.
Well, I was kind of thinking too, in the idea of like forcefully, that there has been a lot of opposition to like the gospel and to it.
Yeah, I don't know if there's been more. Maybe there has. Maybe the fact that John the Baptist is in prison is part of what Jesus is thinking about. Because I'm not sure if there's been more opposition than prior to John. I don't know. Also, what is from John?
I mean, God's always obviously going to do what God's going to do, and it's going to happen. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm just not sure if there's been more opposition. But I'm also not sure what.
Oh, no, I wasn't saying that. It's fine.
I'm not sure what that marker means then. There's also the question of what from John the Baptist actually means. Does it mean from the birth or from the ministry? And I've been assuming the ministry, but maybe it looks different if you go back to the birth. But I don't know. Bottom line is, I don't have any idea. You guys have all made some good thoughts and some good thoughtful replies. I appreciate that. Then he goes on. He says, to what can I compare this generation? They are like children sitting in the marketplace and calling out to others. We played the pipe for you and you did not dance. We sang a dirge and you did not mourn. In other words, they can't control what people are doing, even though they're trying to. For John came neither eating or drinking, and they say he has a demon. And the Son of Man came eating or drinking, and they say he is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is proved right by her deeds. This is just one of those statements that resonates so clearly with our understanding of humanity. Sometimes people are just stubborn in their opposition, and it doesn't matter what the evidence is. And the hypocrisy of our stubbornness and our opposition sometimes can be such that we will be claiming to be appalled at what somebody we don't like does. And then if somebody else we do like does the same thing, we're not as appalled. Or if people we don't like do opposite things, we're mad at both of them for opposite reasons. And that's kind of what he's saying here. You were mad at John because he wasn't free enough, and you're mad at me because I'm too free. Clearly, your issue isn't with what we're doing. Your issue is with us. Your issue is with the message. Your issue is with the kingdom of heaven. Your issue is with the gospel. Maybe it connects back to that opposition like you guys were talking about. But then he says, wisdom is proved by her deeds. And I like that, because what's fascinating is he could be saying, look, John behaved one way, I behave another. But what's interesting is we've both been vindicated. John's been vindicated because I am who he said I was. And I did come, and he kept saying I would. And I've been vindicated because you've seen the miracles and you've seen the healings and you've seen all these other things. So it's kind of like he's saying, you know, you can argue all you want, be as stubborn as you want, but get beyond your stubborn opposition and in the face of evidence, and recognize that our wisdom, we've been vindicated. The things we've said, the things we've done have been proven. And even though they were differently done, you can't just stand in opposition because you don't like us and you don't like what we're saying. I mean, you can, but it doesn't make sense. Luke chapter 7, similar story. Let me just read it. I mean, same story, some different details. John's disciples told him all about these things. Calling two of them, he sent them to the Lord to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else? Again, it's very minor, but the fact that here it tells us he selected a specific two and sent these two, it could just be that he just selected two because that's what he did, but it could be that these two needed to see this and that this could be the indication he's doing it for them. It's not a proof by any means, it just crossed my mind. Are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else? And when the men came to Jesus, they said, John the Baptist sent us to you to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else? At that very time, Jesus cured many who had diseases, sicknesses, and evil spirits, and gave sight to many who were blind. So he replied to the messengers, go back and report to John what you have seen and heard. And here Luke makes it especially clear that they literally have seen these. This wasn't something that happened over, you know, they asked him a question, then he said, tell them what you've seen. They came, they asked him a question, he said, watch me. And then he did all these things, including apparently raising the dead. So they may have been there during the raising of the widow's son, during the healing of the centurion. I think that's very possible. They've been here through this period. And that's why he's saying, now go back and tell them what you've seen. Those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. Yes, Meredith, you raised your hand.
I was thinking too, I mean, it would be good for them to know also, because the point is not for them to follow John the Baptist. The point is for them to follow Jesus.
Right. Absolutely. That's why it makes sense to me that he might send them to Jesus instead of answering their question himself, because he wants to affirm.
I think his choosing of two people could also make the case for John feeling some concern as well, because he would pick the people he trusted to not freak out if he's feeling a little bit of doubt and to convey his message accurately and return to him. So I think either way it could be.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, if I was John, I would be feeling a little, and also too, I mean, because Jesus hasn't brought about any judgment yet. And then also, I mean, when like Jesus came, I wonder too if John did have this picture of it like happening faster or something too, because too, like when Jesus came to get baptized and like John is like, this isn't how it works. And like Jesus, and he's like, you need to become more and I need to become less. And then maybe it didn't quite happen as much in that. And then he got arrested and like other things. So yeah, maybe it doesn't exactly.
No, I think that's entirely not only plausible, but if I were writing a story, I would write it that he was actually doubting. And there's two reasons why, because it's very powerful. Again, this doesn't reason the reason it's true, but it's very powerful then to see Jesus be so gracious, to have John come to send people to him with doubt and have Jesus respond to that doubt by affirming things, but then turning to the crowd and saying, John is not a reed swayed by the wind, to turn to the crowd and say, John is strong and faithful after hearing that John doubted. There's something beautiful about that. The second reason that it's a beautiful and powerful story is because this is just before John is going to be executed. And it's nice that he gets this confirmation before he has to face his own death. Because if he had to face his own death with that doubt, that would be sad. That would be a bummer. I mean, it would be gone once he died, but it's still, it's nice to know that he went to his death having had the confidence and the confirmation from Jesus. So if I were to write a story, I would write it that way. But I have learned not to confuse that with interpreting scripture to know what's true.
Yeah. I mean, if I were John, I'd probably do that.
Yeah. Well, it is comforting to us too, to know that even John can doubt and it's okay. And Jesus was okay with that. He didn't freak Jesus out. Yeah. After John's messengers left, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed swayed by the wind? If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No, those who wear expensive clothes and indulge in luxury are in palaces. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. I tell you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John, yet the one who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. All the people, even the tax collectors, when they heard Jesus' words, acknowledged that God was right, because they had been baptized by John. But the Pharisees and experts in the law rejected God's purpose for themselves because they had not been baptized by John. This is an interesting footnote by Luke, well, at least in our translations, literal parenthetical phrase, and it is parenthetical, that as Jesus said this, it was easier for those who had followed John to accept Jesus. And it was harder for those who had not followed John to accept Jesus, which all goes to the point that John was a success. That's what I love about it, that it's saying John may be having his doubt, he may be in prison, but what Luke is pointing out is that John succeeded, that he tried to point the way to Jesus, and for the people who listened to him, he did. They were more inclined to hear what Jesus said and believe him, which is cool. That again, is a comfort, I think. If John knows that, it's a comfort to him too. Jesus went on to say, to what then can I compare the people of this generation? What are they like? They are like children sitting in the marketplace and calling out to each other. We played the pipe for you and you did not dance. We sang a dirge and you did not cry. For John, and again, I didn't say it this way before, but the point also is, what do you want? Do you want people to dance or cry? Well, they don't, they just want to be in control. They don't care which. And that kind of is, as he goes forward. For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you said he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, but wisdom is proved right by all her children. Any other comments on that story before we wrap up with just a couple more verses in this chapter?
Well, so this has always been like a little bit confusing to me. So when it's we, it's saying that the people are saying, we played the pipe and you didn't dance. We sang a dirge and you didn't cry to Jesus and John the Baptist.
Correct. He's okay. Saying you are like children in the marketplace calling out to each other those things.
Yeah. Well, I was also kind of thinking too, they're also like trying to like make it like all about them. Like right. The authority there.
100%. Yep, I agree. Wrap up some verses here just to kind of finish off the chapter. It says, then Jesus began to denounce the towns in which most of his miracles had been performed because they did not repent. "Woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable for Tyre and Sidon on the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be lifted to the heavens? No, you will go down to Hades. For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Sodom, it would have remained to this day. But I tell you that it would be more bearable for Sodom on the day of judgment than for you." I think his point here is, you've seen John. John was a prophet. John was verified by his children, by his fruit. His wisdom was vindicated. You've seen me. You've seen the miracles. That vindicates both John and me. You've watched all this happen. You have so much more evidence of the reality of the Messiah and of the God of the universe than Sodom did, than Tyre did, than Sidon did. You have so much more reason to believe, and yet you still don't. And so because of that, your judgment is going to be worse and greater. And you can take that literally. I don't have a problem with it being literally, that there are different levels of judgment. Does sort of mirror our understanding of justice. Or you can see it metaphorically and hyperbolically. It doesn't matter. The point is just that they are, again, a generation that is like, well, we want you to sing when we want you to sing. We want you to cry when we want you to cry. We don't like what you're saying. And Jesus is like, if you would just get over your stubbornness and your desire for control, you would see that you have had so much clear evidence that John was right. And I am right, and you need to recognize that. You need to hear it. And then he goes on and says this. At that time, Jesus said, "I praise you." So he says this judgment. He says this warning. He's like really strong. And then he turns to this prayer. He says, and he even says, at that time, Jesus said, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and the learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this is what you were pleased to do." Again, the whole point about God chooses to make himself accessible to the lowly, to the poverty, to the poor in spirit, that those who think they're so smart and they're like, well, John did this and he's a demon and Jesus did this and he's a glutton. People who think they're so smart are the people who are actually under more judgment because they're not paying attention. But to people who are just recognize that they don't know what's going on and they're just watching what's happening and they're responding to it. And they're like, wow, this is really amazing. You know, the children, the lowly, these are the people that have access. I don't think it ultimately means that people of power can't have access. But again, it's Jesus turning things on their head again and saying, you think only the powerful, the rich, the super spiritual, the religious, these are the only people that have access. But thank you, Father, he says. And this is one of those clear moments where Jesus is praying a horizontal prayer. We all have all done it. A horizontal prayer is where you pray to God, but you're hoping other people are listening. And Jesus is doing that in this case. And he's praying, you know, thank you that you are making yourself accessible to the poor and the lowly. So that those out there listening to his judgment, to his warning, if they're starting to be afraid, he wants them to know, you don't have to be afraid. I'm here for you. God's here for you. And then he goes on to say that more specifically. He says, all things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. So before you get caught up on, well, Jesus is picking who he's revealing to, which does say here, before you get hung up on that, there's more to come. But what he is saying is, again, the access is through the Son. It's not through anything else. It's not through your religion. It's not through your power. It's not through your birthright. It's not through your lineage. It's not through your works of righteousness. It's not through your prestige. It's not through how smart you are. It's none of those things. None of those things your access. Your access is who Jesus chooses. That's it, period. So you've got no other hope except to be chosen by Jesus. But then he goes on to say this: come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. So right after saying, no one will know the Father except those whom the Son chooses, Jesus then makes it clear that he chooses those who come to him. He chooses any who want to come to him. And he says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Look, if you're happy, if you think that you've got it all together, if you've got the world by the tail and you think you're in control of everything, you're probably not going to come to me. I get that. But if you're feeling burdened and you're feeling weary and you're tired of this rat race of trying to be as righteous as the guy next to you, trying to do what the Pharisees are telling you to do, the Pharisees put a great burden on the Jews. Jesus says that elsewhere. Their yoke is heavy. A yoke is what an oxen carries, right? So an oxen has a yoke that attaches him to the plow or the cart or whatever it is he's pulling. And the yoke can be heavy or it can be light. And this is, he's saying that in contrast to the Pharisees' heavy yoke, Jesus is saying this: come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. I really love the fact that Jesus doesn't just call the humble. He says, I am humble. I am gentle, because some of the burden is that the Pharisees are not. The teachers of the law are neither humble nor gentle. And it's very hard. You know, if you're trying to please somebody who isn't humble and gentle, it's such a burden. It's so difficult to get there. And Jesus says, I am humble and gentle in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And I think it's all of that last part is just back to the access is there for those who want it. You don't have to do a heavy burden. You don't have to be, you know, carry the burden of being the smartest, the best, the most faithful, the most, you know, self-denying, the most religious. You know, you don't have to be born into the right place. I'm calling you and I'm telling you my yoke is light. You don't have to carry those burdens. I'm just calling you to rest. And if you come, I choose you. And I'm not getting into the Calvinist questions. There might be more than that, but at this moment, that is what he's saying. The only way to the Father is through the Son. And the Son says, come. And if you're weary, come. And if you're tired, come. And if you need rest, come. I'm not asking you to do more work. I'm not asking you to work harder. I'm asking you to take a yoke which is easy and light. And I think the implication is it's easy and light because Jesus is carrying it all. So that's it. That's the end of Matthew 11.
Thank you for joining us. The Journey is a ministry of Discipleship Matters, which is an extension of Focus Church and is created by David McGill for the purpose of helping equip pastors to build discipleship communities in their own churches. If you'd like to learn more about the books and conferences and coaching offered by David, you can check out his website, davidmcgill.com.